All right, so we're back in session. today, or in this lecture at least, I want to introduce you to moral philosophy more broadly and sort of give you an explanation of what happens in moral philosophy, what kinds of questions we're interested in asking, and try to determine just what it is that we'll be doing over the course of the semester. So, what is moral philosophy? Well, I think the best explanation of moral philosophy is that it's simply the discipline or the subdiscipline of philosophy that tries to answer the question, how should I live, or how should we live? There are many ways of going about answering that question, and it can be a complicated question, but the basic idea is, how should we spend our time while we're here on the earth? What things should we care about? What is truly valuable in life? And what things should we be pursuing with our time and our resources? So there are lots of different ways we could go about answering this question, but one way we might begin is by just simply coming up with a list of rules that we could all live by. And when I think of, a list of rules, it's just sort of very basic rules that come to mind are, things like don't kill, don't steal, don't cheat, don't harm. This is one way we could go about determining whether or not we're living the right kind of life. And, if we adhere to these rules with some measure of consistency, then we could be said to be living a moral life. If not, then we're not living a moral life. One of the problems, of course, that might arise immediately is how do we determine which rules are true and which rules are false? And a further problem is we might ask whether it even makes sense to ask whether the rules of morality are true. I mean, think about it. The idea that I shouldn't tell lies, right? Or if you said don't lie, I might ask, well, why not? And it's very puzzling and very interesting to think about just what makes morality valid in our lives. And it's interesting to think about whether or not we're talking about truth or falsehood at all when we make moral claims. One of the things that you have to keep in mind as we begin is that in moral philosophy, we're not doing anthropology or sociology or psychology, where you might be interested in providing a descriptive account of various events in world history or contemporary events that are going on right now. Instead, in philosophy, we're doing what's called normative, or we're providing a normative account of the way things should be. And when we talk about normative claims, we're really talking about the way things should be. Here's an example. When a sociologist might ask this question, right? What do Americans feel about the war in Iraq? Well, obviously there are ever so many positions that could be taken up and defended on that score. But if we were to survey a vast number of Americans trying to determine what it is that Americans actually do believe about the war in Iraq, we might come to some kind of consensus, right? The survey would yield some observation that we could, point to and say, look, this is what Americans actually do believe, right? Or we might be able to say this at the very least, that, 65% of Americans believe such and such about the war in Iraq. In moral philosophy, we're not asking what do Americans believe about the war in Iraq, but we might be interested in a slightly different question. This question: what should Americans believe about the war in Iraq? Now, of course, even in this case, there are ever so many positions that could be taken up and defended. But the emphasis here is not on what Americans actually do believe, but instead on what should Americans believe, right? And so you can see already that the project is very different than providing a descriptive account. Normative accounts strive to determine what the world should be like rather than what the world is like. Okay, and that's something to keep in mind as we go forward. All right, so think back to the list of rules that I sort of introduced just a few minutes ago. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't kill, maybe keep your promises. We could begin there, right? Keep your promises. Now, most of us believe that keeping our promises is a good idea, but very few of us believe we should keep our promises no matter what. We can imagine cases where it might be important to actually break a promise, and breaking a promise may be the moral thing to do. For example, imagine that you and I make an appointment that we're going to meet together to discuss an upcoming paper. And you promise me that you're going to be at my office at 2:00, and I make arrangements to meet with you as well. Now, on your way to the campus, you witness a car accident, and the person who has been in this car accident is badly wounded, and you happen to be in the medical profession. And so you feel obligated to remain behind and break your promise to me and actually help this person. Now, it seems that, of course, this is the moral thing to do. Actually, breaking your promise to me is moral in this case, right? So we can imagine cases like this where breaking a promise might be morally permissible. And not only morally permissible, but morally required in some cases. Lying is also an interesting case. Many people believe or seem to believe that lying is morally wrong, and generally speaking, most of us believe that that's the case. But at the same time, we can imagine cases where telling a lie would be morally permissible, at the very least. Right? For example, imagine that you're planning a birthday party for your friend, and he or she asks you what you're doing on Friday night. And of course, you're planning a birthday party for him or her. So you lie. You say you have plans with your family and you won't be able to spend any time with him. And so you tell a lie, but of course your intentions are not to deceive him in a malicious way. Of course, you want to surprise him with this party. So even here, telling a lie can be morally permissible in some cases, and most of us feel comfortable with those determinations. What else? Well, I guess those two examples, or three examples, however many I provided, those examples show us that we can have rules, and rules, generally speaking, seem to guide our lives and provide us good counsel when we're trying to determine the difference between right and wrong. Rules can be very helpful to help us make those determinations. However, the fact that there are exceptions to the rules and that we sort of recognize that there are exceptions to the rules is a very important aspect of living the moral life as well. And determining just what an exception case is and what qualifies as an exception case is also a very important aspect. And of course, these rules, as well as their exceptions, can be misapplied, and unfortunately this happens all too often. Right? As you'll see later on in the course, it's possible and frequent, I imagine, for us to imagine that we're actually in an exception case when we're not really in an exception case. Right? Given the facts of human psychology, when telling the truth would be embarrassing to me, I'd rather lie to get out of a tight spot, right? And I might imagine that I'm actually in an exception case when I'm really not. So I've got to be careful, right? As I apply these rules and think of myself in exceptions, one of the things you want to ask yourself is, am I really in an exception case or not? Okay, so what I want to do, of course, over the course of the semester is, think about what it means to be in exception cases, what it means to not be in an exception case, and try to determine just when exception cases are valid and when they're not. Okay, let's see. One of the things, I mean, right now I just want to sort of unfold for you exactly what we'll be doing and some of the questions that we'll be trying to answer over the course of the semester. So one of the things that will interest us is also what it is that undergirds or justifies the claims of morality, right? How is it that we, you know, when our mothers tell us that we shouldn't tell lies, for example, what is it that makes it the case that we sort of find ourselves believing her when she tells us that we shouldn't tell lies, right? And of course, there are a range of answers that could be offered here. Most students seem to suggest that, well, that's just what our parents teach us, and gradually we come to accept the claims of morality. But I want to go even further than that, because it's not just that your mother has taught you not to lie. When we become reflective later in life, right, we can actually disagree with our parents. And so even today, we think, you know, now that we're adults, we can think independently of our parents and our mothers. And it seems to me that most of us would still agree that lying is wrong, but now we need to find justifications beyond, you know, the mere fact that, yes, our parents have taught us the difference between right and wrong. So there are ways that we can go about that. One way is to talk about God or religion, right? Religion or God as the source of morality, right? And this way of justifying the claims of morality is sometimes called the divine command theory. Now, the divine command theory isn't necessarily a bad way of going about justifying the claims of morality. However, it has one major drawback, that it won't be compelling for those who don't believe in God. Right. So there's a lot of work to be done. First of all, we have to show that there is good reason to believe in God. And of course, that's not really germane to what we'll be doing in this class. But nevertheless, if you are interested in the divine command theory, that's something that has to be established, right? We have to have good reason to believe in God. So for those of you who believe in God, then the divine command theory may actually be a viable option. And in this case, you would simply think of the rules of morality as divine commands, right? And of course, the rules of morality would gain their validity because of their basis in perhaps the character of God or the divine order of the universe or whatever it is you think would be appropriate in that case. For our purposes, we will not explore the divine command theory in any depth beyond just mentioning it here. Other theories that we will spend time developing and looking at closely are, for example, the social contract theory. Now, this is also called contractarianism. And we'll spend at least a week and a half developing and trying to understand the social contract theory. The basic idea here, unlike the divine command theory, is that the rules of morality really represent basic agreements that we enter into with one another, right? So there isn't any appeal to a divine authority in this case. The rules of morality simply represent contracts, sort of social contracts, that you and I implicitly enter into, right? So by virtue of being a social being, human beings enter into these kinds of contracts with one another. There are implicit agreements that come along with friendship, and simply getting by in life implies the ability to get along, to cooperate, to coordinate our behaviors with other human beings in order to gain from the advantages of living in society, right? So the rules of morality sort of emerge from our social intercourse with one another, right? Let's see. The third way that we can justify the claims of morality is simply to appeal to the principles of rationality, right? And we'll turn to this way of substantiating the claims of morality when we look closely at what Immanuel Kant has to say. For Kant, the moral life is a reasonable life, right? And so if we are to be reasonable creatures, and of course Kant argues that we are by nature capable of rationally ordering our lives in a moral fashion. So if we are to be reasonable or rational, we will have to live the moral life, because the moral life is the rational life, and the rational life is the moral life, right? So to be rational is to be moral. And this is a radical, well, not a radical view, but it's not at all radical, actually. It's pretty mainstream, and it's a dominant view that has sort of occupied the attention of many philosophers in the Western tradition. So that will be one of the things that we look at very closely. A fourth possibility is, consequences, right? One of the things that we care about are the consequences of our actions, or the results of our actions, right? And we can determine the difference between right and wrong by determining what the consequences of given actions happen to be, right? If I tell lies, generally speaking, telling lies will lead to bad results. And this may be a way of substantiating the claims of morality, right? There are certain types of actions that, generally speaking, will lead to bad results. And there are other types of actions that, generally speaking, will lead to good results, right? And so we want to encourage people to perform actions that lead to good results. And we want to discourage people from performing actions that lead to bad results. Pretty simple. That view, of course, will develop into something called utilitarianism, which we'll spend a great deal of time developing and thinking about. Lastly, another view, I guess this is the fifth option that we could talk about, is something called expressivism, or sometimes also called emotivism. Now, emotivism or expressivism claims that the rules of morality gain their validity from not reason, but from the passions, right? So in other words, we learn from our emotions the difference between right and wrong. And it's not, the idea here is that we cannot derive the rules of morality from reason alone. And the argument here is fairly complicated. We'll turn to this argument when we move from Immanuel Kant to David Hume, and we'll look at some of Hume's criticisms of what Kant had said about the powers of reason. David Hume doesn't believe that we can derive the rules of morality from reason alone, and that won't really make sense to you until we've sort of explored what Kant has to say about the nature of morality more fully. So for now, we'll just sort of think about, you know, possible ways of justifying the claims of morality. For the most part, you've most likely never really thought about how to go about justifying the claims of morality, or you've never entertained moral skepticism to any degree, right? Now, moral skepticism is a position, of course, that sort of challenges the claims of morality, right? If I were to say it's good to tell the truth, a moral skeptic might ask, well, is that really the case? Is it really good to tell the truth? What do you mean by good? And what possible justification could you provide me with that telling the truth is really good, right? So the moral skeptic will often ask a question like this, a question that has really, I wouldn't say terrified moral philosophers, but certainly has disturbed moral philosophers for a very long time. The question is, why be moral, right? Why live a moral life? That's a very difficult question to answer, and moral philosophers have struggled with that question for a long time. Now, of course, you might think, well, isn't it obvious? Living the moral life is what's morally required. That's why we should be moral. Well, that's an obvious answer, of course, but it's an answer from inside the moral life, right? If you imagine a sphere or a circle, and if I'm standing inside the circle, I'm standing inside the moral life. Well, one thing you could say is that, yeah, from inside the moral life, it makes sense to live a moral life. But what if I'm standing outside of the moral life, and I now ask the question, why be moral? It becomes a far more difficult question to answer at that point, right? And of course, the point here is that I cannot appeal, right? When I'm standing outside of the circle, I can no longer appeal to morality itself in order to justify the moral life. I've got to appeal to something else. And that's why the list of five possible justifications of morality was important, right? We could appeal to God, perhaps, or to the social contract, or to some conception of practical reason or practical rationality, or perhaps to expressivism or some kind of conception of utility. We'll turn to all of these and we'll explore them in more depth as the semester progresses. All right, so let's return to that question for just a moment. It's not a question I want to entertain for a long time, but it's a question that you should grapple with nonetheless. The question is, why be moral? And as I said, from inside the moral life, it makes sense to just simply say that, well, the answer is that it's morally required. Why be moral? Well, because it's moral. But from outside the moral life, it makes very little sense to simply say, well, that's what's morally required. In a sense, this question is premature, right? And I'm setting you up in such a way that this question will be difficult for you. One of the things that we'll want to do is determine just what it is that morality requires of us. And of course, you may have some intuitions about what morality requires, but you don't yet know exactly what the content of the course is going to be. So when the course is over with, I think you'll be in a far better position to answer the question, why be moral, right? For one thing, you'll have some exposure to what kinds of positions have been taken up in the history of moral philosophy in the West. And by virtue of that exposure, you'll be better positioned to answer the question, why be moral? Okay, so let's see. Why don't we start with, well, we're going to start with utilitarianism. And of course, utilitarianism is a theory of the content of morality. In other words, it's a theory that tells us what morality consists of. Right? Now, we're going to start there, as I said, with utilitarianism. And then when we're done with utilitarianism, we're going to contrast that position or that view with other views. We're going to compare and contrast utilitarianism with Kantianism and then with social contract theory or something called contractarianism. And then we'll look at some other positions. And finally, we'll end with a sort of analysis of some of Nietzsche's criticisms of morality more broadly. Let's see. If we're going to start with utilitarianism, one of the things that we're going to have to do is sort of build ourselves up to that point, right? And so we can't simply begin with utilitarianism. We have to find out what makes utilitarianism click. So over the next little while, I'm going to sort of develop or provide a framework within which utilitarianism functions. And it won't look like utilitarianism until I'm done with that. So essentially what I'm trying to do is make the view, utilitarianism, as attractive as possible. So I'm going to set things up in such a way that once we get to utilitarianism, you'll be able to see how it works and why utilitarians think the way they do. Once we get to utilitarianism, of course, you'll notice almost immediately that utilitarianism does suffer from some fairly serious problems. Now, I should say something about moral theories in general. Moral theories, no matter which one you're dealing with, moral theories always suffer from problems, right? And utilitarianism is no exception. Kantianism will also have its problems. There is no theory that doesn't have problems. So sometimes it's just simply a matter of deciding which problems you're willing to live with, right? Okay, so anyway, back to this question, right? Why have any morality at all? Or why be moral? And a possible solution or reason for living a moral life is twofold, right? First of all, it seems to be the case that actions have results, right? And that seems to be a rather uncontroversial claim, that actions have results. I can't think of any reason to reject a claim like that. when we perform actions, those actions have results. They may be very minute results, but in other cases, they may be very large results. Results that sort of impact others around us. And the basic idea here is that, you know, we're not alone in the world. The results of our actions seem to matter to people. And of course, that's the second point, is that results actually matter. Another way of saying the same thing is just to say that some results are better than others, right? So that if you believe these two things, right, that actions have results, and two, that results matter, or that some results are better than others, that would make you a resultist, right? Someone who believes that the results of an action are morally relevant to determining whether an action is right or wrong. Now, this is an important definition, and you should probably write this down. Resultism, then, is the position that says the goodness or badness of results are morally relevant to determining whether an action is right or wrong. So you'll want to keep that in mind. Now, resultism itself comes in two distinct forms. We could say that there are bold resultists, and we could say that there are moderate resultists. A bold resultist is someone who says that the only thing that matters when I'm trying to determine whether an action is right or wrong are the results. Now, the moderate resultist agrees that the results are important, but does not agree that the results are the only thing that matters. Now, this is an important distinction, right? Again, the bold resultist believes only the results matter when I'm trying to determine the difference between right and wrong, while the moderate resultist says that yes, the results matter, but they're not the only thing that matters. Right? Moderate resultists might care about things like intentions. Right? Not only the results of an action determine whether an action is right or wrong, but the intentions behind the action. In other words, the motivations that help the action to emerge. Those are also good things to pay attention to when you're trying to determine whether an action is right or wrong. So, imagine that I took a shovel and hit you in the face with it. The bold resultist would say, okay, so what are the results of that action? Right? And of course, you can imagine what the results would be. They would be fairly bad results. You might have a broken nose or a fractured cheekbone. So what we might determine is that the action of hitting you in the face with a shovel is morally wrong because it leads to bad results, right? Bad results for you. The moderate resultist would want to pay attention to the results as well, but would not only pay attention to the results, right? The moderate resultist might want to say, look, what were his motivations for hitting you in the face with a shovel, right? So there may not be any motivations, there may not be any account or any justification for hitting you in the face with a shovel, but you can imagine it being an accident, in which case it was not my intention to hit you in the face with a shovel. And that, of course, seems to be morally relevant to whether or not hitting you in the face with a shovel is wrong, right? And of course, that's precisely why the moderate resultist does not want to only pay attention to the results of an action. Okay. So again, the bold and moderate resultist. Bold resultist says only the results matter when I'm trying to determine the rightness or wrongness of an action. The moderate resultist says, yes, the results matter, but they're not the only thing that matters. Okay. Now notice here that some philosophers, historically have rejected the notion that results are relevant at all. Now that seems very strange, a very strange position to take up, right? I mean, if you were to say, me hitting you in the face with a shovel produces bad results, right? I might break your nose and fracture your cheekbone. It's very strange to say that that doesn't matter at all when I'm trying to determine whether that action is right or wrong. I don't know, as far as I'm concerned, it seems that results are morally relevant when we're trying to determine the rightness or wrongness of an action. They may not be the only thing that matters, but they're certainly relevant to determining whether an action is right or wrong. It's very strange to say they don't matter at all. So, I mean, as you sort of contemplate how we might go about identifying actions that are right and actions that are wrong, keep that in mind, right? It makes very little sense to say that results don't matter at all, even though you may want to pay more attention to the motivations behind a given action. All right. Let's see. Maybe this is enough for today. We've done, or at least for this lecture. I think I'll pick things up from here, and I think we'll pick things up from here, and we'll be able to say more about the trajectory of resultism when we return. All right.